This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We feel very strongly that the type of partnership the United States brings and can bring is inherently different from what other partners bring.
That was U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai on how Washington is prioritizing increased trade with Africa. Details coming up. Also, China has trained at least 2,000 African Security Force officers since 2018. And Africa's top fossil fuel producers say the continent is not ready for an oil and gas-free future. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Last night, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel will have overall security responsibility in Gaza after the conflict with Hamas ends. He was speaking in an interview with the U.S. television network ABC. Netanyahu also said Israel is open to what he called the little pauses in the fighting to allow the release of more than 240 Israeli and foreign hostages Hamas holds in Gaza. U.S. President Joe Biden spoke to Netanyahu yesterday and pushed for humanitarian pauses. In addition, Biden has advised the Israelis against trying to occupy or control Gaza after the war. Netanyahu's comments come as much of the world is calling for an immediate ceasefire and the unimpeded flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. The United States has stopped short of calling for a ceasefire, with officials saying it could allow Hamas time to regroup and attack Israelis again. However, President Biden is facing growing pressure from the public and his Democratic Party to push for a ceasefire. For more on the U.S. response to Netanyahu's comments, we have VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain on the line. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Cindy.
Thank you, Yehia. It's my pleasure.
So, Israel may assume, will assume, overall security responsibility in Gaza for an indefinite period. Very curious. Has the Biden administration directly commented on Netanyahu's statement of controlling security in Gaza?
Well, we have not heard much yet. We still have briefings to come here this afternoon in D.C. from the State Department, and we'll have the National Security Council Coordinator John Kirby at the White House. So people will be listening very closely for any reaction, but this was kind of a new thing. It seemed that the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu was floating this plan. It was the first that many had heard of it for Israel to be responsible for Gaza security. He said for an indefinite period after the war. And previously, this is different than what the Israeli defense minister had been saying. And as you and your listeners probably know, Secretary of State Antony Blinken had a grueling tour of the region, going to Israel and the West Bank and Iraq and Turkey, and speaking with people. And Secretary of State Blinken had indicated that he thought that the Palestinian Authority with President Abbas would be perhaps best suited to administer Gaza after the war. So sounds like this is another point where the U.S. is not agreeing with the Prime Minister of Israel.
And Biden and Netanyahu discussed the matter as recently as yesterday, you know, according to the White House, though no apparent agreement was reached.
Yes, that's right. What we are hearing for that is that President Biden was pressing Netanyahu for what he called tactical pauses, not an overall complete ceasefire, but short pauses to try to get more aid to the Palestinians, try to let Palestinians get to safer areas, if there is such a thing, that they could, you know, get out of Gaza City, which is now basically surrounded by Israeli defense forces.
Any statement from Secretary Blinken?
Well, we've had Secretary Blinken is now trying to pivot to Asia. He's in Tokyo for 2 days of talks with the G7. And what he basically said there, he acknowledged that, you know, it was sort of, he called it a work in progress with the talks with Israeli officials and his other talks in the Middle East. But he said it's important for the G7 countries to come together, and he said speak with one voice on this Israel-Hamas war.
And there are growing demands around the world for a ceasefire. Thousands of people have rallied in several countries in recent days. So how does the Biden administration, how does it look into the matter, basically the protests around the world?
Yes, yes. You're right, and I believe that Secretary Blinken got an earful in Turkey and in the West Bank and in Iraq about that, with the countries pressing for a ceasefire. And the U.S. has not called for a ceasefire yet, just these what they're calling pauses, not an overall ceasefire, because Israel has been very adamant that it would only benefit Hamas. But as you are correct in saying, the pressure is increasing with every day that now we're the Palestinian, the authority in Gaza says that there have been 10,000 people killed in Gaza.
So is the growing concern among Americans and members of Biden's Democratic Party over the humanitarian crisis in Gaza likely to shift the administration's stance?
I think that the U.S. More than likely behind the scenes is urging for more to be done, concrete steps to be taken to protect civilians, and also that this cannot be an ongoing, never-ending onslaught, that if Israel needs to, I think there's pressure for Israel to wind this up.
That was it. State Department correspondent Cindy Sain, really appreciate your input.
Thank you so much for having me.
In Israel, many people marked the start of the conflict with Hamas 30 days ago. More than 1,400 Israelis died when Hamas militants attacked Israeli communities on October 7th. Since then, more than 10,000 residents of Gaza, including about 4,000 children, have died in the Israeli bombardment of the Hamas-run enclave. Much of the world is calling for an immediate ceasefire and the unimpeded flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. The United States has stopped short of calling for a ceasefire, with officials saying it could allow Hamas time to regroup and attack Israel again. For more on the situation, we have journalist Linda Granstein on the line from Jerusalem. Welcome back to African News Tonight, Linda. So start out by briefing us on the latest developments today.
Well, as you said, it is now a month since the war began on October 7th. And in Israel, there were lots of ceremonies, moments of silence, to mark that month, memorial events. One interesting thing, by the way, is that apparently officials in Thailand, the Thai foreign minister, says that he's met with officials in Qatar and Egypt, and that 24 of the hostages who are from Thailand, who are being held in Gaza by Hamas, will be the next to be released. And the other interesting thing was that the Thai official said they've received proof that all of these captives, who were agricultural workers who were employed in Israeli farms near the Gaza border, who were kidnapped along with hundreds of others, are alive. So that's kind of an interesting development in the hostages. A total of 240 people are being held, and Israel has not had any kind of sign of life from them. So the fact that Thai officials are saying that their hostages are still alive seems to indicate that at least most of the Israeli hostages are also still alive.
So as I mentioned earlier, last night, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel will have overall security responsibility in Gaza for an indefinite period after its war with Hamas. So, Linda, how are Israelis and, Palestinians reacting to Prime Minister Netanyahu's comments that Israel would take security control of Gaza after the fighting ends?
Well, it's not clear exactly what that means. I mean, even before the war, Israel had security control of Gaza because Israel controlled the airspace and controlled the entry and exit into Gaza. So is that what Netanyahu means? I don't think most Israelis want Israel to reoccupy Gaza and the 2.2 million Palestinians who live there. Even before the war started, Gaza was a very poor place. More than a million of the Palestinians who live there are refugees. More than half of the population are unemployed. So I think what Netanyahu means is just that, you know, Israel will continue to control the airspace and control the entry and exit into Gaza. But who's going to be in control on the ground in Gaza is something that at this point nobody knows.
And much of the world is calling for an immediate ceasefire and an impeded flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. A few is trickling in through the Rafah border with Egypt. How's the aid trickling in into the Gaza?
So Israel has said that it will not allow aid in through its crossing point called Kerem Shalom. So the aid is coming in through Rafah. The situation is very difficult. Israel has opened a humanitarian corridor from the north of Gaza, where most of the fighting is, to the south. And, for example, today a lot of Palestinians waving white flags were able to move along that corridor. Now, Israel's been calling for almost a month for Palestinians in northern Gaza to move south. Israel has surrounded Gaza and is sort of poised to enter the tunnel network that is underneath Gaza, the humanitarian situation is growing increasingly desperate. A couple of hospitals say they're on the verge of shutting down, and you have millions of Palestinians, not millions, you have hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who are sort of either taking refuge in United Nations facilities, which really don't have the ability to take care of them, or sort of wandering around the streets. I mean, remember, Hamas was in control of Gaza, and now the Hamas leadership is basically underground. So there's really kind of a chaotic situation in Gaza.
And lastly, Linda, there are growing demands around the world for a ceasefire. Thousands of people have rallied in several countries in recent days. So, from where you are, how do Israelis feel about those demands and criticism of how Israel is conducting the fighting?
Well, I think Israelis kind of feel that Israel has to get rid of Hamas as the, at least as a military power and as the people who, you know, were in control of Gaza. I mean, what happened a month ago on October 7th when thousands of Hamas gunmen overran 20 Israeli communities, really murdered people and, you know, children in very brutal ways, took 240 hostages, including babies and toddlers without their parents. I mean, you know, how do these, you know, who's taking care of these babies and toddlers who have been in captivity now for a month? I think that Israelis feel that now is not the time to stop, that Israel has to kind of go all the way against Hamas while trying to minimize the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. But I think Israelis aren't really thinking about what happens after the war ends and who's really going to be in control and how Gaza is going to rebuild.
Journalist Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem, thank you for your input.
Thank you.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. China has trained at least 2,000 African law enforcement and military officers since 2018 at the People's Armed Police Schools. Some regional experts say this education is part of China's strategy to promote its governance model and advance its political, ideological, and military interests. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
For several years before the COVID-19 pandemic, China offered 100,000 scholarships to students, civil servants, military officers and media practitioners every 3 years through the Forum for China-Africa Cooperation. In a recent study published by the United States Institute of Peace, military training takes 2-3% of the scholarships offered to Africa. Paul Nantulia is a research associate at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He says China is expanding its influence beyond economic development.
The Chinese military is essentially a military wing of the Communist Party of China. Now, that is also key in the sense that the Chinese military is also a political actor in its own right. So it also interacts with political parties, it interacts with parliament, and its political commissars are included in delegations that visit these different African countries. So that's the reason why I refer to it as military political work. The key objective is to build influence and to build familiarity and to build build interoperability with African forces.
Many liberation forces in Africa, including Zimbabwe's ZANU-PF party and South Africa's African National Congress, received extensive military support and training in China. Those ties to China's People's Liberation Army remain today. Earlier this year, South Africa held training exercises with Chinese and Russian forces. China trains African security officers on its history, military doctrine, use of political commissars in running the affairs of the state, and use of artillery, air and land power studies. China's Communist Party uses the party army model, where the military is loyal to the party, not the constitution, government or state. In many African countries, military forces have shifted away from this model since the introduction of the multi-party democracy. Instead, military leaders pledge their allegiance to the constitution. South Africa-based political analyst Nsikelelo Brekfa says any training that teaches the military to interfere with the civilian rule undermines democracy-building efforts in Africa.
It goes against the democracy as understood by many, arguably, on a global scale, you know. So the omission of separating these three entities, the military, the state, and the party, might be seen to be a bit problematic, and then poses a danger to the construct of a democracy in the modern era on the African continent.
Some African political parties and political elite have used the military to help them run the affairs of the country and manage the population. Human rights and political experts say that has resulted in a lack of respect for constitutions, human rights violations, rigged elections and leaders staying in office long after their terms ended. Ntulia says Africa needs to keep uniformed forces away from civilian rule.
We look at all these coups that have taken place, and we also look at Africa's history of military government. So yes, African countries have the freedom to train with whoever they want to train with, but they also need to take cognizance of the fact that that they're duty-bound to respect their constitutional principles, to respect those constitutional provisions, and to ensure that partisan control of the armed forces is eliminated, because the dangers are obvious and do not bear repeating here.
In the past 3 years, 6 African countries have experienced coups, and transitioning from military rule to civilian government has become a challenge. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
The United Nations environmental groups and other organizations are urging the world to stop using fossil fuels and to focus on sustainable energy. Some richer countries are funding African transitions to using cleaner energy with billions of dollars. But Africa's top fossil fuel producers say the continent is not ready for an oil and gas-free future. Darren Taylor reports.
As long as rich countries buy our oil, we'll keep producing it. That was the message from Africa's major oil exporters, including Nigeria, Angola, Algeria, Egypt and Libya, at the recent Africa Energy Week event in Cape Town. These nations have big oil and gas reserves, which attract international investment. Oil production contributes significantly to their economies and export revenues. But scientists say burning oil and gas for power and transportation produces more than 40% of global greenhouse gas emissions, which drive climate change. Carbon also is emitted during the extraction and processing of oil and gas. Roland Ngam head of the Climate Justice Project at the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, told VOA it's unfair of richer countries to dictate energy policy to Africa.
Since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, a lot of money has poured into Africa for oil and gas projects, about $500 billion worth of investments. And the African countries are saying, well, hang on a minute. If we have to chop and change our policies just based on your energy projects and plans, then certainly that is not right. That is a form of neocolonialism and so on. We are talking about a just energy transition process. So the just part is also part of the argument.
After Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022, many European nations cut their purchases of Russian oil and gas, replacing them with supplies from Africa and the Middle East. Vice President of the African Energy Chamber, Werner Ayukegba, wants investment in the continent's oil and gas sector to double to $200 billion by 2030.
I really would love to see more projects. Gas to power infrastructure around exploration is certainly not enough. And that is why we at the African Energy Chamber, we continue to plead for even more investment. We need significant amount of investment for partners across the world, across the entire value chain. But we also need investments internally. How do we shorten development time to ensure that this gas cannot just be developed to be shipped to Asia and to Europe and to America, but it needs to be piped into African power plants. It needs to be piped into African industry.
Ayukegba told journalists during a webinar presented by the chamber that the keys to Africa's progress are industrialization and reliable power. He added that renewable energy sources are not enough to achieve this. At the same time, though, Ayukegba emphasized the chamber is dedicated to eventually moving away from dirty fuels to clean energy.
Transition is an imperative. However, we do believe that Africa needs to have the right and the opportunity to be able to transition at its own pace, facing its own reality. That means the way you transition in Lagos is not the same way you're going to transition in New York. So in as much as we're in this boat together, we do have different priorities. And so we need to ensure in Africa that we cater for the reality of those people whom we live with and whom we represent. That means we need gas in Africa to be able to provide as much power and energy as we need.
Scientists say Africa already bears the worst of climate change, with drought and floods across the continent. By ramping up production and use of fossil fuels, they say, Africa's punishing itself and the world. For Ngam at the Climate Justice Project, the way forward for Africa is to create a well-balanced mix of energy sources which allow economic growth and a gradual move toward lower emissions. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And fresh fighting between the Ethiopian army and a local militia in the northern Amhara region has raised concerns for the safety of historic rock-hewn churches in the holy town of Lalibela. Reuters News reports that Fano militiamen overran Lalibela and Gondar, the second biggest city in the Amhara region, for several days in August. On Sunday, Ethiopian soldiers fired heavy weapons 11 times from locations near the churches. A deacon said the shooting sent damaging shockwaves through one of the subterranean monuments, which dates back to the 12th and 13th centuries. He said the vibrations are affecting the 11 cave churches, which were carved out of monolithic blocks to form a new Jerusalem after Muslim conquests halted Christian pilgrims to the Holy Land. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Tien Wong, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.